Okay, these three readings seem to be very disparate, but actually they fit together very well, and I hope to demonstrate that and what I have to say. But just a little note. In first century Palestine, spit was considered like penicillin or antibiotics. So that's why you had Jesus spitting all over the place and doing stuff with spit and blah, 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 blah. So their medical knowledge was, of course, limited. So what is going on in these three readings? What is the problem? They have a common problem. And it is a question of the human community, as it always is for Jesus. So when we have in Isaiah this series of handicaps, blindness, deafness, limping, being crippled, being mute, all of those are sins. All of those are seen by the people in Isaiah's time as a result of some kind of demonic influence. They had some kind of explanation as to why people got sick, and it was because there was some evil power afoot and afflicting people. And of course, for the Jews, for the essence of sin was always the breaking of relationship, putting people on the outskirts of the human family. So what is going on is not just this blind person who couldn't see. Now, now I see, I got this bonus from God. No, that stops short of the real meaning. That is, if these people are cured, that means what? They're brought into the human family. They can now participate in the life of the community. And this is even more explicit in this reading where this deaf guy is made to speak. What does it mean to have a voice? Because that's what we're talking about. It means to be somebody. To have a voice is to be able to be heard. And to be able to be heard, you have to assume that there's a person speaking who is worth hearing. And so here, too, we don't just have some kind of benevolence bestowed on people, but the meaning, the ultimate meaning of the cure of the mute was to make him somebody that people could see and hear and listen to. And this is not all far-fetched, I don't think, because even today, the advantage of growing up with Nyanvi, who, as everybody knows, had polio when he was 5. People still stop and stare at him as if he were some kind of object of curiosity or fascination. And I think we used to have a bunch of handicapped people, and it was very clear that people would simply stare at them, objectify them. So they're not real people, not real three-dimensional people, but they stopped at that handicap, and that's all they saw. And this business of stopping at the surface, of course, is exactly the heart of this message from James. When I was preparing this several days ago, I thought again of the bishop's dinner. Every bishop has a dinner. You know, every bishop has a dinner. And the more you pay for your dinner ticket, the closer you can come to sitting next to his nibs. I mean, think about it. We do it in London. We do it every place. Everybody does it. But what's the problem? The problem is we don't see this person. We don't see this person as person. We see objects. An object that's well put out, that smells good, because poverty, one of the great problems of poverty is that poor people tend to smell bad because they can't wash and don't have any clean clothes to put on anyway. So here's this guy with his Armani suit, you know, driving up in his Maserati, and everybody's saying, oh my God, look who's here, look who's here. And so we get all excited. and some poor bugger from off the street. It looks like he fell off a Goodwill truck. Well, find someplace, you know, at my feet. What's the problem? We stop at the surfaces. We stop at the surfaces and we objectify what should be a living human being, turning him into a thing, a nice thing or an unpleasant thing. And James puts it out so boldly, so clearly, it seems to me, to hold a mirror up to ourselves, to our own responses to people. And unhappily, this impulse is not dead. So the guy who is in charge of the highest court in the Vatican, the former bishop, Archbishop of St. Louis, a cardinal now, of course, Raymond Burke. I don't know whether you read this. But in the past week or so, Burke delivered himself of the following profound opinion, trying to account for priestly pedophilia. The reason we have pedophile priests is that they don't respect canon law adequately. Think about that. They don't respect canon law adequately. Because if they did, of course, this thing, canon law, this thing would be the filter through which we are able to achieve the humanity of somebody else, or which keeps us from achieving the recognition of the humanity of somebody else. We still do it. I mean, that's one of the more egregious examples, one of the sickest fruits of a clericalism, of a society, of a culture which sees itself in possession of the ultimate truth and everybody else is something of a bozo and inadequate. If it, you know, if it were some clodknob from off the streets, you know, you say, well, goofiness is universally distributed in the world, but he's not. He's the highest judge of the highest court in what is supposed to be our church. Again, it's this thing, the code of canon law, which is a quite substantial thing. 2,300 canons, I think, laws. Because we don't approach another human being, a little kid, through that canon, through that filter. Then the little kid gets lost somehow in her own self-righteousness or blindness. So it's a caution, it's a cautionary tale for all of us to understand. It's the same, you know, it's the same message refracted through any number of lenses, the three lenses of the reading today. What keeps us from seeing the other in their otherness as truly co-human? Because this was the genius of Jesus, it seems to me very clear. And I tried to say when we read that horrible thing from Ephesians about wives being submissive to their husband, etc., etc., etc. We erect all these barriers which occlude our vision. So we can all end up praying with the blind man in the parable, Lord, that I may see.